Position number 13107, row 1.
Mr. Miles, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
Dover. Kent.
You were telling me you're partly of Norwegian origin?
My mother's Norwegian. My father's English.
Was your father from Kent?
Yes, Tunbridge Wells in Kent. He was quite a cricketer. Played for Kent Colts in his early days.
Did you go to school in Dover?
I did, yes.
I didn't ask you when you were born.
31st of January 1910.
How old were you when you left school?
12.
Did you get a job?
Yes, there was an examination that one could do over the bad old days immediately after the First World War. Providing you sat an examination called the labour examination, and if you passed that, you were allowed to leave school and get a job. And if you were of poor parentage, that's what happened. And that's what happened to me. So I left school at 12 and got a little job at 8 shillings a week, old money.
What did it involve?
Errand boy in a shop.
How did you come to be in the Navy then?
Well, I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere as an errand boy, and there wasn't a lot open to us with no education. So I thought, well, one or the other, and I always had a fancy for the Navy, so I put in and joined the Navy as a boy in 1925.
Was it easy to get in?
As a matter of fact, the first time I applied, I failed. On a trivial thing, I was knock-kneed. So the doctor told me what to do to overcome this knock-knee business and try again in 6 months' time.
What did you have to do?
Sit on a chair backwards, instead of with the back facing you see? So that your legs were open and round the back, and it helped and work on that.
So it worked, didn't it?
It worked, yeah.
Can you tell me about your initial training at Shotley?
But as in the Navy?
As a boy?
Oh, dear me, yes, at Ganges at Shotley. Yeah. Yes, that was almost a year. And it was pretty hard going. We had two instructors, one for seamanship and one for gunnery. The seamanship instructor was a lovely man named Barker. The gunnery instructor was an absolute so-and-so. He'd never had a training class before, and he never had one afterwards. He was a terrible man.
In what way?
Brutal. Absolutely brutal. Parker. The seamanship man was Barker, and he was Parker. And he was a terrible man. They were both chief petty officers, of course.
Did you get knocked about by him?
Me personally, no. But one or two, yes, did.
What type of things would he knock them about for?
Well, we had a boy. His name was Rice. I've never seen him since, but it's something that sticks in your memory. O.G. Rice. He was the only boy in a class of 53 who shaved. We were 15, and he was tall, very dark, and he had to shave. And Mr. Parker came in half drunk one night, about past 9 at night, to see that we were bedded down. And in the bathroom was a mug with shaving water in it. Now, he didn't have to ask whose shaving water it was. He knew that there was only one boy that shaved. However, we were terrified of him. And he came in and asked whose shaving water it was, and of course there was no reply. We were absolutely terrified. However, Rice had to own up. So he did, he owned up. And Parker knew that it was him anyway. So he called him out and he took him into the bathroom. And he blacked his eyes and kicked him. And this is absolutely true. We had a big stove in there to keep the room warm. But the fires were drawn before we went to bed, but the stove was still very hot. And he made him climb on the stove, on top of the stove. Now, he couldn't stand still. The stove was hot, and he had to keep dancing. He took him off there, and our beds, we all had a nice bed with a spring, single spring, you know. And he gave him a dustbin and made him dance on the bed with that dustbin. That was the sort of man he was. Now, this was most unusual. He was renowned throughout the whole of the Ganges at that time. And I don't know anybody else that ever suffered like that, like we did. And the same thing, if he took boys under punishment from anywhere, the way he treated them was beyond description. Terrible.
So he was removed, was he?
Yes, he was removed.
Job.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, he never lasted. And then after I joined submarines, I was in Chatham Barracks one day, and I was walking through the barracks, and who should I meet but Mr. Parker? This was, let me think now, 8 years afterwards. And I saw him in the distance of somewhere around about a quarter of a mile, and I knew him. I knew who it was. That's how he's stuck in your memory. Now, he must have known me as well, because he suddenly turned round and branched off and went somewhere else. He came to a bad end, I understand. Somebody told me he lost a leg for some reason or another.
In the war?
No, before the war. Mm-hmm.
Why was this other chap, Barker, such a good chap?
He was a pensioner. And I don't know what he would have been at that time, somewhere around about 50, I suppose. But I think he was such a good chap because the other one was so bad, if you follow what I mean.
You mean
he made up to us. You see, we did week and week about. We did a week of seamanship instruction and a week of gunnery instruction. And he knew about Parker. And so when he took us, he was wonderful. And I think that's the reason.
Did the seamanship instructors have a better reputation generally than the gunnery instructors?
No, the reverse. The gunnery instructor had more education than, from a professional point of view, than the seaman. Yeah.
Was the discipline strict generally in China
yes.
in those years?
As boys,
yes.
Yes, but it was a very happy time. This is 1925. It was a happy time, other than this particular episode with this chap. But the food was wonderful. I mean, I'd never eaten so well in my life. The food, because they were building us up, weren't they, you know?
Why was it so good? What type of things did you get?
Well, it was good because we all wanted building up. We were boys who'd probably been living on bread or whatever, you know? So when we went there, we had a hot breakfast. Well, we started off in the morning at 6 o'clock with hot cocoa and biscuits. Then you went and did physical training on the parade ground. You came back to breakfast. It was always bacon and egg or bacon and tomatoes or a really good hot breakfast, a very good hot lunch, and supper. Oh, yes, it was very, very good indeed.
What about this going over the mast? That they had to do at Chatham.
Oh, yeah, that was part of the training, yeah. And you had to do that. Well, most boys were afraid of the mast. But you had some who would go and stand on the button with no problem. But that was... you only did it once. It wasn't a continuous thing. You were there about 11 months I was in training at Chatham. And I went up the mast twice, I think.
Did you personally have any problems with the training about things that you found difficult to learn?
Yes, swimming. Swimming was my only trouble. Although I lived at Dover all my life, I couldn't swim. And that was wrong. That you should have been able to swim because they were pretty tough on the swimming. They'd make you jump in the deep end and then hold a pole out for you to get hold of because you couldn't swim to pull you out. But instead of that, very often they'd push you under with it. I mean, that kind of training was absolutely ridiculous. from then on, when I left Shotley, I knew that I had to be a good swimmer.
Did you learn to swim at Shotley?
Oh, yes, I had to. You had to do swim two lengths of the bath and stay in for 3 minutes fully dressed. That was the passing out test.
So if you failed to learn to swim, you wouldn't be passed out of Shotley?
I never knew anybody who failed that test eventually after 11 months. 11 months training, you know.
But do you say you were happy at HMS Calgary?
Yes, I was happy then, yeah. Yes, I was happy there. I lived well, I fed well, I was fit, and the sport that we played was excellent, cricket and football and everything. All the training was wonderful. It was just the instructor that one had.
Do you think that the training at Ganges prepared you for what was to come later?
Probably? Absolutely, absolutely.
Which branch of the Navy did you go into once you'd finished?
Well, I went in for torpedoes eventually, but that's the electrical branch. We not only did torpedoes, but we were responsible for the electrics throughout the ship.
Did you go into that voluntarily, or were you directed?
I was directed, but I wanted it. I opted for that. You either did that or gunnery, and I preferred that. So I opted for that, and I got it, to my amazement.
Can you tell me about some of the skills which you had to learn for the torpedo side?
Well, we did our training in Vernon, Portsmouth. That was the torpedo branch in the Vernon. And we learned electrics and torpedoes in there. How to change fuses and chase earth and all that sort of stuff. And also the operation of a torpedo.
Was that as enjoyable as Ganges?
Very. Oh, much better. Because we were then qualified. We were able seamen then in those days. Oh, yes, that was wonderful. And then we'd go ashore at night and do pictures and all that sort of thing. Oh, yes, that was great.
You were in the Navy in 31 when this Invergordon mutiny took place. Mm-hmm. I know you weren't in Invergordon, but
yes, what was.
Were you in Invergordon? Mm-hmm. I thought you were in Chatham.
I was on the cruiser York at Invergordon.
What are your memories of the mutiny?
Hmm?
What are your memories of the mutiny?
Oh. Well, of course, there were two rates of pay in the Navy at that time, if you remember this. And I was on the new rate of pay. The new rate of pay came in on the 1st of October, 1925. And I joined the Navy on about a week later, about the 12th of October, 25, on the new scale of pay. And the new scale of pay was a reduction of a shilling a day in the wages. And this was a Labour government, of course. And it really started from there. People joined before the first, were on the old scale of pay, getting a shilling a day more than I was, which at 2 and 6 pence a day to 3 and 6 pence a day was a lot of money. So Invergordon mutiny started over that. They wanted to bring the top rate down to the new rate. After having said that they wouldn't do so, you see. And that's what caused the mutiny. Now, they were rather silly about this, because a chief petty officer who was earning so much money was also, they tried to duck him a shilling a day, the same as an able seaman, or an officer, which was wrong. They didn't graduate it, you see. This is what caused the mutiny. So utterly stupid. And so it was from there that I was on the York at the time, and we had a representative, and I joined in the mutiny, but simply because we were rather sorry for the other one, the older people. And I always remember standing on the forecastle when the commander coming along, they read the riot act to us and so on and so forth. It didn't mean anything to me. I was already on the new scale of pay. But one felt sorry for the people who were losing it. So from there, we were sent back to our own ports and we were paid off, you know, the ship paid off and so on. And I thought to myself, well, I don't know. Things began to get a bit tough and rather silly things that they did. And I had the idea then that I would join the submarine service.
But, who organised the mutiny on the...
That's a very, very different story. We had a chap, a leading seaman, who was considered to be our ringleader, and he was dismissed the service.
Was he the ringleader? Mm-hmm. What was his
name? Yes, I think so. He certainly had a lot to do with it anyway.
What was his name?
I couldn't tell you.
But how did you hear of what you had to do, as far as mutinying was concerned?
It was all rather slap happy, as far as I remember. We were on a mess deck, and this came up that at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, we're going on strike, and that's it, and that's what happened. 8 o'clock in the morning, they hoisted the air jack and so on, and then everybody down tools and never did anything. And that was how it was done, as simple as that. I think it was the Warspite, sailed out of Invergordon Harbour for sea for exercises at 7:30 that morning. And she was outside the harbour when it struck 8 o'clock and they stopped work. And that was rather difficult because it appeared to be what they called mutiny on the high seas. However, the Warspite, I think it was the Warspite, turned round and came back to harbour. To re-anchor, and the anchors and everything else was dropped by the officers. You know, they just didn't do anything.
But what was your first... How did you get the first news of what the government or the Admiralty had decided?
Well, then I can't remember. I know there was a big meeting ashore in the canteen at Invergordon on the night prior to all this happening. And that's where everything was detailed, what they would do.
Did you go to that meeting?
I wasn't there, no.
Why not?
Well, I was too young and I wasn't interested. I wasn't losing any money. When it actually took place, we decided to help. And that's what we did.
So just some message came by word of mouth through the ship, you mean?
More or less, yeah. I can't really describe it. It's how we were told at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, I can't remember.
But were you worried about what would happen?
Oh, yeah, very. Very, very worried. I mean, we were committing mutiny, unheard of in the British Navy. It always amazed me that. They reckoned that it did the country a tremendous amount of harm. I don't think I quite agree with that. I reckon it showed people abroad, Russians or Americans or whatever, that we had the guts to stand up for ourselves, and I think that went a long way to it.
What did happen to you? Were you punished?
No, not directly. I mean, discipline tightened up. In funny ways. For instance, I was stopped 7 days leave or something for wearing, remember the naval shirts with the blue top? Flannel shirts. Well, at that time, we were getting a bit conscious of our dress, and in the summer we would wear white ones, a thin white shirt with a blue top.
What do you mean you were getting conscious of your dress? How do you mean you were getting conscious of your dress?
Well, we were getting smartened up and so on, and a thick flannel shirt was very, very warm in the summer, so we were conscious that we didn't want to do that, so we tried this, and it was illegal, but it was... Before the mutiny, it was always accepted. But that's one thing they did. They stopped that. And I happened to walk about one day with a shirt on with this collar, and I was stopped 7 days punishment. And I said to a friend of mine that, I don't know, things are looking a bit tough. How about volunteering for submarines? And that's what we did.
But during the mutiny, was everybody in HMS York in agreement?
No. No, we were one of the ships where I suppose maybe 30-40% were in agreement and the remainder were not. Mostly the senior rates. See, they had a lot to lose. But on some of the ships, it was 100%.
So 60 or 70% in the York was against taking an action?
No, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. About that.
But you were in the 30 or 40%.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
What did the others say in the 60 or 70%?
Well, they just didn't take any part in it. They carried on as normal.
Did that mean there was any bitterness between the... Between
yes,
the
there was a certain amount of bitterness. Mm-hmm. It was bound to be. But not to us. You know, the ones already on the new scale of pay. No bitterness there, but to the others who were going to lose and letting somebody else do the striking and not to themselves, like a blackleg. Well, that was different. Mm-hmm.
So how did the bitterness show itself?
Not a lot, I suppose. It made just a bad feeling all through the ship. I think probably one of the reasons why we paid off.
What were the officers like in the York?
Oh, never any problem there. I don't think any of us did. We got along with them. The only one that ever seemed to take any notice was the commander. It fell on him to deal with it and try and get us to go back to work and not be so stupid, as he said. But
do you remember what he said?
No. I know they read the Riot Act.
What effect did it have?
None. None at all. By this time, you see, you could see all the other ships in the harbour. Battleships and cruisers and everything else. All on a strike.
So was it this that made you join the submarine service?
Really speaking, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you go about it?
You volunteer. And you have to do a very severe medical. Which you did. And then went into Chatham Barracks. And I suppose I was in there a month. And I was called on to do another medical. Which I did, and then I was drafted to Gosport HMS Dolphin.
Which year is this?
Which year?
Yes.
32. It's a day that I shall always remember, the 5th of May 1932. It was the finest thing I ever did in my service career.
Why?
I loved every moment of it in the submarine service. I went over, there were six of us from Chatham Barracks. I went across from the Vernon. I went up on the pier into HMS Dolphin. And the atmosphere was completely different. It had a smell, which I take it was diesel oil or something. There was something about it. And I felt at home straight away. And I never ever looked back. And I say I had a wonderful time in the submarine service.
Had
a few sticky moments, obviously, but...
Was it because the discipline was more relaxed?
People get that idea. The discipline is self-discipline. The discipline overall, yes, is more relaxed. They depend upon you to carry out the discipline yourself without being organised to do it. And that happened. Anybody who didn't fit was out. And the right, so.
Where did you train for submarines?
In Dolphin at Gosport. 3 months training.
What kind of things were you expected to learn there?
Well, there were two sets of it. One was called tanks. That was the actual running of a submarine, flooding tanks and blowing tanks and all that sort of stuff. And the other one was electrical. Had the batteries and the torpedo side of it and so on. And... So I did my training, and then I joined a submarine called L-71. That was my first submarine in Chatham Barracks, and I was a torpedoman on torpedoes in the fore ends. I wasn't there very long. Then I got sent out to China. But I was still with torpedoes. Once a torpedoman, always a torpedoman. But it was a great life.
Which boats did you go out to China with?
Well, I went out there on an army troop ship called the Lancashire. And it was the first time any naval draft had been sent out in an army trooper. And that wasn't funny. Their food was terrible. When I got to China, I joined a submarine called the Phoenix. And I was only in her about 6 months, I think, and I was promoted to leading seaman. Well, on promotion, you have to leave the boat and go somewhere else.
Why is that?
Well, you can't more or less take command of people that you'd been messing with in the same rank. Change. So I then went to the Parthian. And I was in her for 2 years before coming home. And promotion was rapid in those days, where we used to have to wait 6 years for leading seaman to petty officer. I passed for petty officer, and I was a petty officer in 8 months. So I went out to China as an able seaman and came home as a petty officer.
What is it called, the Parthian?
Parthian.
What kind of duties did the boat have in the Far East?
The boat, most of it, of course, was exercising, you know, with destroyers, airstick running for them to pick us up with airsticks and so on. But the one job we had to do was piracy patrols. There was a lot of piracy going on at that time in Bias Bay and Mers Bay. And we used to do a week up there, because we could go into Bias Bay, dived, and all, amongst all these islands, and wait and hope for the pirates to return into Bias Bay, you see. But we never ever caught anybody. They did before us, but we never caught any. It used to be a good thing for us. We used to go duck shooting.
Why do you think you never caught them?
Well, Bias Bay and Mers Bay were very big bays with hundreds of islands. And nobody knew them like the Chinese did. And they knew exactly where we were, and they knew exactly where to go when they did a bit of piracy. Yeah, no, we never caught them. But that was what we did mainly.
What was the life like for a submariner in Hong Kong?
Wonderful. You see, one has to remember that Our pay was twice the normal. In those days, we used to get 2 and 6 pence a day for being a submariner, and you got 1 and 3 pence a day for serving in a submarine, and then you got another shilling a day for every night you slept in the submarine, hard-lying money, as it was called. And it was double what the general service section was. So financially, we were all right, so we could afford to go ashore far more than the ordinary lads. However, in my case, that was rather a secondary thing to join the submarines. You know, money was very good.
Did the submariners, like some of these soldiers I've heard about in the 30s,